The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. Last time we began a discussion of the phylum Mollusca. I guess at an early stage in the discussion, it would be well to talk a little bit about phylum characteristics. For my invertebrate zoo students, I encourage them as we begin the semester, when we get to the individual phyla, in each case, try and find some unique characteristic, some characteristic that makes the organisms in that phylum different from all the rest of the organisms in the world. Now, there are, for most phyla, that's possible. For example, for arthropods, you have jointed feet and or the exoskeleton. For protozoa, you have unicellular organisms, and so on. But for the mollusca, there really isn't a single unique characteristic. So in order to separate the mollusca from the rest of the phyla, you have to use a series of characteristics. There are certain things like a mantle. Some people refer to it as a pallium, which is simply a lining between the shell and the body mass. But not all of the organisms in mollusca have that. And there are other things that are often listed as well, but you can list them. For example, the radula, the little rasping structure that you find, probably the best example would be in a gastropoda, the snails. But not all organisms have that. So it's a little tough to pick a single characteristic that is unique for all of the organisms in the phylum. The mantle, in some cases, is specialized into gills or lungs. The shell is a common characteristic, but not all of the organisms have a discernible shell. And the shell structure is quite different. And so you can look through, go down and look through all of the, I guess the only single one that is, single characteristic that is found in all the organisms is an open circulatory system. But this is certainly not unique to the phylum. There are other phyla that have the same thing. So that's a problem. The excretory system, metanephridia, is a good example in some of the organisms, but not all of them have that. The type of reproduction is great for some of them, but it's different from others. Whether you have both sets of reproductive systems in one organism, the dioecious organisms, or whether there is a single set of reproductive organs, male or female, in a single organism, the monoecious, and you have a variety, you have both of those kinds of characteristics present, and a whole number of other things. There are certain structures, certain stages in the life cycle, trochophore larvae and so on, veligers, that are quite unique for some of the organisms, but they're not phylum characteristics. So it's just a little tough to come up to distinguish all of the organisms of mollusca uniquely from all the rest of them. So it's just it's an individual kind of thing that you have to give your attention to. Now, we had talked last time about the monoplacophora, and they are of interest primarily because they are organisms that the evolutionists thought were extinct, had been extinct for hundreds of millions of years, and yet back in 1952, there were some of these organisms that were dredged up off the coast of Costa Rica. So simply from that standpoint, they are of interest to us presently. The polyplacophora, common name for these things are the chitons, and they're very interesting. They are little flattened oval-shaped organisms that have a series of plates that distinguish the polyplacophora. They are not of any major importance. They're not used for food. They don't destroy things, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just interesting to note that they exist, and they would be one of the organisms that you spend a little bit of time on, at least in studying the phylum. There is another class that we can dispose of rather quickly, the scaphopoda, the so-called tooth-shelled organisms, not of any major importance. They are of interest in that they exist, but they are not generally used for food, and they're not, there are a lot large numbers of them, and they don't destroy things, et cetera, et cetera. So we will leave those three minor orders of the six, excuse me, not orders, classes, those three classes of the six really are of little interest to us other than simply being aware that they exist. But the remaining three are of immense interest and importance in some respects. The first of these is gastropoda. Many of the names here have the suffix P-O-D-A, which means foot. Scaphopoda, tooth-footed, literally, a description of the shell that they have. The gastropoda, the stomach-footed organisms. Now, the gastropods, of course, are the snails. If for no other reason, they are important by virtue of the fact they are alternate hosts for certain of the parasites. And for this reason, they are worth noting. The size, there is a marine form, Pleuroplocha gigantea, a snail shell up to 60 centimeters long. Now, that's going to get up beyond 3 feet. So there are some of these that are fairly large. There is one, a sea hare, that will be up to a meter, roughly 3 feet. And there are some fossil gastropods that were up to 2 meters long. Now, this gets us up to 6 feet. We've talked about the fact that fossil organisms, as far as I am aware, every organism that we know that is alive today, the fossil representatives were larger than those that we find today. It's true in insects and arthropods and so on. So it's not surprising then to find that there are fossil representatives larger than the ones that we see today. There are some of these that are used for food, the whelks being an example. I don't know that these are, the conchs are used for food as well. These are the shells that are twisted and particularly in the South Sea Islands are used for horns since they can drill holes in them and make sounds that can be heard for long distances. The shells of these organisms are very interesting in that as the organism grows, they may have to leave a particular shell and grow a larger one for themselves. In my mind, the unique characteristic for the snails is simply the radula. This is simply a little rasping structure that is found in the first portion of the digestive tract. And particularly for, the snails feed generally on plant material, and it is an excellent tool for rasping away plant tissue. There are some giant African snails that subsequent to the Second World War, there were specimens that were brought in packing cases from Africa. And I recall that in I think it was a Navy base at Charleston, somebody who was aware of these snails in Africa and the damage they can do to plants happened to notice one. And they went in and burned the packing cases and took precautions for a fair distance around them to be sure that they had gotten all of the organisms before they were able to migrate into the vegetable and fruit growing areas in South Carolina, the southern part of South Carolina. Our interest primarily for these things, I think, has to do with the fact that they are the alternate host for many of the parasites. And for that reason, they are worth noting in passing. Some of you may enjoy eating snails. I will confess that there have been occasions where I've eaten some, both soup and the organisms themselves. My response to eating was mixed, I guess. I would not refuse to eat them again, but by the same token, I wouldn't trample folks getting to them. For those who enjoy them, that's fine. And by the way, for those of you that don't know, the ones that are eaten generally are raised on cornmeal. Those that are simply moving around in nature, they get a bit gritty. You just don't go out in the pasture someplace and pick them and bring them in and cook them. And those that are intended to be eaten are prepared differently and are fed differently. One of the intriguing characteristics, abilities of snails. I remember seeing a video of a snail which was climbing up over the edge of a razor blade. Now, this is a neat trick. The snail, of course, moves along on its muscular foot, and it secretes a mucus coating wherever it goes. And between that mucus coating and the softness of the foot, it was possible for the snail to crawl up one side of a razor blade over the top and down the other side without slicing itself in two. And there again are both Monoecious and Dioecious. There's some other characteristics that we could talk about. I'm not sure it is worth our spending time here. It is interesting to me to look at some of the evolutionary diagrams involving the so-called evolution of the snail. These, again, involve organisms that are imaginative. We do not find them at all, but they are still used as illustrations in the textbook. So here you have a group of organisms very different from even the other organisms of the phylum. And they are important for varying reasons. But there's not anything we can look at that would be their ancestor, and they certainly are not ancestral themselves to something else. And to my mind at least, pose a rather formidable problem to the evolutionist.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.